Now, though, above 13K. I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and so great that you've joined us today. It's a pleasure to have you along with us here as we go through a couple interesting topics on the radio program today, actually all under the heading of one topic, but we're going to look at it from a couple of different angles with the guests that we have lined up on the program today. The topic that I'm talking about that is so important, especially in our day and age, is the topic of tolerance. That's the subject that we're going to speak about today on the program. On the first half of the program today, I'm going to speak with Mindy Bells, the editor of World Magazine. Mindy has just returned recently from a trip to Africa, and the articles that she has written about her trip there are very, very interesting and very appropriate for the subject that we're looking at today, dealing with the subject of tolerance. Related to the article that Mindy wrote called Nowhere to Run, it appears in the latest issue of World Magazine. It's the March 10th issue of World Magazine. It deals with cities, and the cities that they're looking at are both some international cities and some domestic cities as well. But the article that she wrote about Nowhere to Run is the one that I want to focus on today, because it deals with the subject of the lack of religious tolerance towards Christians, especially in parts of Nigeria. Just an astounding collection of attacks, she lists in this article, by Islamic extremists who have viciously attacked Christians throughout that country, mostly in the north, I think. But we're going to hear from Mindy exactly what is taking place there. And I'm hoping towards the end of our discussion, after she lays out what exactly is taking place there, I'm hoping to ask her, you know, what does this mean in light of the recent apologies by our president over the burning of the Quran that took place over in Afghanistan? Obviously, there's different ways of talking and looking at that subject, but it just seems something is way out of balance when that receives so much attention. And I've heard little or nothing about what is taking place, except through World Magazine, of the just the horrendous, vicious attacks that are taking place upon Christians all throughout Nigeria. So that'll be the first part of our program today. Mindy Bells, editor of World Magazine. On the second half of the program today, our guest will be Dr. D.A. Carson. And with Dr. Carson, we're going to be discussing his latest book called The Intolerance of Tolerance. As you know, tolerance currently occupies a very high place in Western society today. It's considered ridiculous, really, to question it at all. But in this book, The Intolerance of Tolerance, questioning tolerance is exactly what Dr. Carson does, at least questioning the contemporary understanding or usage of the word tolerance. And so there's where we're going to go in our discussion with Dr. Carson. We're going to talk with him about what has changed. There's been a change in this word tolerance from the way it was used years ago to the way it is being used today. We've got to be discerning and understanding how people are using that word. So we're going to talk a lot about the definition of it and how that actually plays out in society today. And I'm hoping, I sent him a copy of a recent news item about Rick Warren builds bridges to Muslims, or builds a bridge to Muslim I wanted to ask him his take on this article. It came out in the Orange County Register. And basically, it says in the article that that Rick Warren is partnering with Southern California mosques and proposing to set a set of theological principles that includes acknowledging that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. And so I want to talk to him about the parts of this effort by Rick Warren that Christians can agree with that are brought out in the article, and the parts of it that venture over into this new meaning of tolerance. We're going to talk about that on the second portion of the broadcast today. So with that, Mindy, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Hi, Kevin.
Mindy, you heard, I think, in my introduction there where we'd like to go, but I was hoping that from your trip to Africa that you would set the stage for us on some of the things that you saw and heard and recorded in this article. I've got to say, wow, you're one of the most courageous people I know. In light of what is taking place, obviously, recently with so many journalists there, I'm glad you're back safely, and it certainly is a privilege to have you on the program to talk to us about what's taking place.
Well, let me say, first of all, you know, I think that a lot of Americans are very familiar with the situation in Sudan, the situation in some of the North African countries like Libya, where you have had for a long time a steady confrontation between Christians and Muslims. And primarily the form that that confrontation takes is radical Islamic groups coming in to attack and rid a particular area of Christians. And it stems very directly from the difference in what the Bible teaches and what the Quran teaches. The Quran in various places teaches that Muslims are either to convert or to kill those who are considered infidels. Yeah. One of the countries in Africa that has gotten, I think, very little attention in all of this is Nigeria. Nigeria is the largest country in West Africa, and the northern tier of the country is predominantly Muslim, while the southern half of the country is predominantly Christian. What's important about Nigeria is it's the most populous country in Africa, and Lagos, the city on the coast, is the largest city in Africa, and the country itself is set to overtake South Africa in a couple of years as the largest economy on the continent. Mm. And so it seems to me with all of that that to neglect the violence and the conflict between Christians and Muslims there is really something that we've got to stop doing.
Hmm. So I was just overwhelmed when you list in this article the numerous attacks that have taken place. You begin by talking about a medical clinic and a compound that that houses both a medical clinic and one of the oldest churches in Nigeria. Tell us about your trip specifically to that compound and what you saw there.
Well, you know, the trip overwhelmed me in terms of going from place to place. I was able to visit 5 of the 12 states in northern Nigeria. And in each one, I basically did a tour of destroyed churches. And I really wasn't expecting it to be so extensive. I wasn't expecting the destruction to be so complete. I wasn't prepared for the level of devastation to the churches there. And so you have a situation where really over the last 10 years, 13,000 people, and most of those are Christians, have been killed by this kind of violence. 2,000 of those deaths have taken place in the last year alone. Mm. And what typically has happened is that a situation will flare up, as it did last April when Goodluck Jonathan was elected to be the president of Nigeria. He's a Christian. He's from southern part of the country. And there was great resentment and outrage among the Muslim groups in the north. And what they took that outrage out on the Christians. And I was in one compound where the pastors and the local residents described for me how Muslim youth literally came up over the wall of this compound with torches lit by kerosene and even kerosene containers and just began setting fire to every building on the premises. That church is among some of the oldest ones. It was started by what was then the Sudan Interior Mission. It's now called Serving and Mission, SIM, one of the largest mission organizations in Africa. And they started working in Nigeria in the 1930s. And so the church that I saw that they had destroyed, I mean, it was literally burnt down to its concrete foundation. And it was a huge church. This was a church that would have one or two services a Sunday with, you know, 800 or more people at each service. That church was destroyed. The one that I visited, which was actually in Kano, which is the largest city in the north, that church has been spared, but it has been listed on a web site that is a posting by Boko Haram, the terrorist group. I'm probably getting a little bit ahead of you, Kevin, there. But the terrorist group that has now also come along to threaten the churches. This particular compound that I visited, school was in session, church was meeting, people were coming and going. And it's basically, you know, has a bullseye on it. It's a place that Boko Haram would like to attack and destroy in the way that we saw in all these other places.
You mentioned there that Boko Haram as being this this new terrorist group that has emerged, has ties to Al-Qaeda and so forth. Your article says this: the terrorist group has vowed to attack police, military, and Christian institutions. It has promised to kidnap Westerners. It has abducted a Brit, an Italian, and a German worker. They have this walled compound then that they're in, you know, and they post guards here on the compound. It says here, violence and threats, including a Christmas Day bombing of a Catholic church that killed 44 and a January warning that all Christians should leave Nigeria, are taking their toll. It seems like just some horrific violence that has been committed by this group. And the name of this group has an interesting, you know, I've said it there, Boko Haram. But what does that name actually mean? And talk about how the meaning of that name is being demonstrated in the attacks that they're conducting there in Nigeria.
Right. Well, Boko Haram is actually a name that has been given to the group by us locals in the area in the far north where the group got started. Boko Haram means Western education is sinful, and it reflects this idea that Christianity is a Western religion and needs to be driven out. But actually, the official name of the group, which is a very long Arabic name, means group committed to propagating the prophet's teaching and jihad. So we see there are sort of the two elements, which we've clearly seen before with Al-Qaeda and its related groups, and that is this idea that you want to either transform or eliminate anything that is not Islam. And what particularly stands out as the enemy to these groups is anything related to the West, Western education, Western openness, Western culture, and what they consider to be Western religion. And, you know, it's interesting that it's always said to me and just so clear in travels in countries that are predominantly Muslim, and I would say in the North as well, we say predominantly Muslim, but that doesn't mean there are no Christians there. And so, for instance, you have two main tribes represented in the North. These are tribes that go back hundreds upon hundreds of years, have a very definite culture, have their own language. And, you know, the assumption, and you'll see this in some reports, they're called Muslim tribes. But in fact, they are not Muslim tribes. They're tribes where some people converted to Islam, some people converted to Christianity, some people still hold on to their animist and pagan traditions. And so to follow this assumption that Christianity is Western, or that somehow Christianity as it's represented in the North is an invasion, is just simply not true. It's no more of an invasion than Islam. And Islam in Nigeria did not arrive there until about the the 1400s or 1500s. And so, you know, we're not talking about an invasion of religion here. We're talking about two religions that, you know, we believe ought to be able to exist and people ought to be able to think and worship freely.
Now, these groups, these Islamic groups that wield a tremendous amount of power in certain areas, they've actually implemented Sharia law. Is that correct? Which causes then not just the these horrific attacks against Christians, but also other forms of discrimination, like not allowing them to own property or conduct business activities, and all of these types of things as well.
Right. And this is really the heart of the problem. Starting in 2012, states, or I should say since 2012, states have enacted Sharia law. The way that has come about, the states have a lot of autonomy. Nigeria has a federal system, not unlike our own. And the states pass their own Sharia law documents. And some of them have done it partially. In other words, some have civil courts existing alongside Islamic courts. Some have done it completely and have a total Islamic court system. They've all done it in something of an individual way. But what it means is, in every case where that has happened, Muslims have gained significant legal and all kinds of power over Christians who live within that state. And four of the five states that I visited all have Sharia law to one degree or another. And in some of those states, you know, the children are required to go to schools where they're taught Islam. The women in some cases do not feel free, Christian women do not feel free to go outside unless they have on Muslim hijab. This is very radical. This is the kind of thing that we think of happening in Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia or somewhere. And yet, you know, Nigeria, when you think about it, is a predominantly Christian country, and yet this has been allowed to slip in. And I think what we're seeing with the advance of Boko Haram is that, you know, it's a pattern we've seen before, that Islam gets a toehold into the way civil society is run through the Sharia court system. And then along comes a violent, radical group that is there to sort of eliminate everyone else who hasn't been subjugated by this court system. And that's what we see happening with Boko Haram. They are violently enforcing what has already been accomplished through the court system.
You give an account in some of the states that you visited. In one here, one city, you recount a pastor giving a rundown of some of the damage and the results of the attacks. He says this: 13 churches were attacked and many homes burned. 5 Christians were killed and 8 members of a Christian ministry group. A policewoman was beheaded in that area. Further north, 2 church women, both Bible study and fellowship leaders, were killed in the eastern part of this city. He pauses, you write, and then he adds, none were spared. There is no church left standing. All Christian homes, all Christian shops destroyed. And then further on down, another area you mentioned, and all Muslim attackers destroyed. 92 churches, 104 houses, 54 businesses. And that was in April of 2011. They killed 30 Christians, injured 69. Further on down in the article, you write, Christians throughout these states in the north faced post-election violence, destroyed 409 churches, over 2,000 homes, killing 137. They destroyed 39 churches, 74 homes in another state, killing 20. I mean, this is just, it goes on and on and on. And just the massive amount of slaughter and destruction that's taking place. What are we to make of this? And is the United States saying anything? Are the liberal media and the United States as the government, are they saying anything about what is taking place there?
One of the problems that I became aware of as I went to these areas and saw the destruction, and keep in mind, it's somewhat difficult to see something that's been destroyed. And so, you know, coming there 6, 8, 10 months after some of this violence meant that I had to actually see the areas closely and talk to people to realize what I was actually seeing. I was given a number of really amazing inventories that some of the pastors have taken. Several of the leading denominations agreed among themselves that it was very important to document all the attacks that they've had. And so I was given, I have here maybe 8-10 inches worth of documentation that gets down to things like pots and pans and blankets and clothing and cars that have been destroyed, and a lot of photographs to go along with it. So I think it's fair to say we have a reasonable account of this level of destruction. And then to answer your question about what the United States is doing about it, I came away very distressed by the U.S. position. I think it's not only maybe to ignore what's going on, but it's actually harmful to the Christians there, because if you look at the State Department reports, the reports by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, these are two government entities that we count on to monitor this kind of thing around the world, and they generally do a very good job of it. But when it comes to Nigeria, they tend to cloak what's happening there in the language of, and I'm quoting here, sectarian violence, violence between Christians and Muslims. There have been instances of retaliation over the last 2 or 3 or 4 years where Christians have actually killed Muslims in response to attacks, not anywhere near to the degree of the Muslim attacks on Christians. And I think what this points to is an issue that will be taken up next week by the UN Human Rights Council that's meeting in Geneva, and that is the whole issue of impunity. The local governments, again, because as we talked about, most of them are Islamic-run court systems, have refused to allow for any sort of justice for any of the assailants in these attacks to be brought to trial or to be in the last 10 years, only 5 of those who have committed these atrocities have actually been sentenced and in some way prosecuted. And that was because the federal government stepped in and actually brought charges against them through the tax courts. So you have this huge problem of impunity, and that has led to some retaliation by Christian groups. I think that the and we get to this in the story a little bit. There's a real problem of Western media reporting these things from the outside and thereby listening to Muslim officials as opposed to actually seeing the level of destruction that I saw on the ground. Mm-hmm. And that has led to these reports that call what's happening sectarian violence, when in fact it is religious violence of Muslims attacking Christians in an effort to drive them out or kill them and rid the area of non-Muslims.
What do you think about this? We only have a minute left in the broadcast, so I'm sorry to toss this at you with 1 minute. But in light of the president, I understand the reasons for speaking out about the burning of the Quran with our military personnel being in harm's way. I understand that. But don't you think that this should be, he likes to talk about teaching moments. Wouldn't this be a wonderful time for a teaching moment about the intolerance of much of those in the Islamic world?
Well, I think also, Kevin, a teaching moment for the role a commander-in-chief should and should not play. Mm-hmm. And what the president did by writing this letter that he knew would be heavily publicized is he went right over the heads of his commanders, not only our U.S. commanders, but the NATO commanders in Afghanistan. And this is a military issue, and it gets to, I mean, we could talk a lot about it. It gets to the rules of engagement we have there, which are very problematic, which keep our soldiers way too isolated from Afghans and set up this kind of strife where, rather than working alongside peace-loving Afghans, we are working against them, and these kinds of misunderstandings and blow-ups happen. I don't think that we should be apologizing for the destruction of a few Qurans when that leads to violence that has killed at least 2 of our own U.S. servicemen there. I think that we have to stay focused on the overall security issues and the violence there. And I think for a commander-in-chief to step in on this kind of issue and override his military commanders is just wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mindy, thank you very much. You're very brave when we read about what's taking place and the way that they specifically are going after Westerners and Western teaching that they call Western teaching there in that area, Christian teaching. But very brave to go into those areas in order to bring this report to the folks here in the United States. Thank you very much for your reporting, and thank you very much for being with us on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me.
Okay, that was Mindy Bells from World Magazine, the editor of World Magazine. Check out the latest issue of World Magazine. Not only is Mindy's article there that we were just referring to, you need to read it for yourself. It's called Nowhere to Run, Longstanding Threats from Muslims, plus New Threats from Terrorists Are Concerning and Cornering Northern Nigeria's Christians. You can check that out on www.worldmag.com. Also, there are photographs there as well of some of the things that were taking place. Tried to give it to you in words, but there's pictures there as well, and you can see it for yourself. Next up, Dr. D.A. Carson is on the program. We're going to talk about the intolerance of tolerance. What do we mean by that? You'll see in a moment.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
You know, the Bible says in Revelation 3:20, it says, "Behold, I stand at the door of your heart and knock." God knocks at the door of people, but it's up to people individually to open up the door of their heart. The doorknob is on the inside.
Right.
That means their mom and their dad can't open up the door of their heart. Your husband and your wife can't open up the door of your heart. We have to do that ourselves personally. Some point in our life, and that's personal, something between us and the Lord.
Amen.
Christian Worldview today, weekday mornings at 7 on Christian Talk 660 and 92.9 FM.
One of the things most alarming to me about today's culture is how evangelicals are responding to attacks against them. Many believe that somehow just having one's heart in the right place is all that matters, that a passion for Jesus and the life of the mind are somehow mutually exclusive. But burning hearts are not nourished by empty heads. We must develop our minds if we are to sustain godly passion and to have a clear message. Hi, this is R.C. Sproul inviting you to the Ligonier Ministries 2012 National Conference in Orlando, March 15th through the 17th, as we consider the theme of the Christian mind. I'll be joined by Sinclair Ferguson, Robert Godfrey, Michael Horton, Steve Lawson, Al Mohler, Stephen Meyer, R.C. Sproul Jr., and Del Tackett. Call 800-435-4343 now to get the early bird rate or register online at ligonier.org. I hope to see you there.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, host of the Knowing the Truth radio program. Let me tell you about a special event called Teach Them Diligently, coming March 15th through the 17th to the Spartanburg Expo Center. Parents will learn how to enhance the homeschool instruction of their children. Speakers include Ken Ham, Vody Bachum, Doug Phillips, and many more. Plus, there will be over 150 workshops. For more information, go to teachthemdiligently.net.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back into the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast today. We're talking about the subject of tolerance. First up on the program today was Mindy Bells, editor of World Magazine. And Mindy was speaking with us about what she saw firsthand, the results of the intolerance, religious intolerance that's taking place in Nigeria right now with the severe, vicious attacks of Islamic extremists against the Christian population there in the northern part of Nigeria. Very interesting report from her, and I think you could see very clearly what is taking place. We want to continue with that subject about tolerance. We're going to do that here in just a moment. Let me just make sure that you're aware of a couple of things before we start the second portion of the program. One, there's an upcoming Pastors Fellowship of Greater Greenville that's going to take place on Friday, March 9th. at Second Presbyterian Church in downtown Greenville. The pastor there is Pastor Rick Phillips. And we're going to be meeting and speaking with Mark Kasson. Well, Mark Kasson is our special speaker at the event. It's just a lunchtime event, 11:30 to 1. Mark is part of Metanoia Prison Ministries, coming from California to speak to the pastors here. And we're going to be looking at how to bring the gospel to inmates. And so if you're a pastor, elder, deacon, you're a leader in the church, you're invited to come to this event. In fact, we're opening it up a bit broader this time. If you're involved or want to be involved in ministry to prisoners, we want to open up this event to you as well. It's just from 11:30 to 1 o'clock. Lunch is included, and it's only $6 to attend the event. I typically give away a number of books at these types of events as well, but just encourage you to come and go out to my website at knowingthetruth.org in order to find out more and to register for this event. Again, March 9th, Friday, March 9th, 11:30 to 1 p.m. Secondly, I wanted to let you know that you're certainly welcome to participate in our discussion today, either via the phone line. We have a toll-free number set up nationwide, 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-9535. Also, I have email up and running. It's kevin@knowingthetruth.org. For your question or comment today, we'll go ahead and send you a copy, courtesy of the publisher of Dr. Carson's brand-new book called The Intolerance of Tolerance. And it's put out by Erdman's Publishing. And so the good folks there at Erdman's will send you a copy for your participation in the program today. And then one final note. Tomorrow on the broadcast, we'll be talking about a portrait of Paul. We're going to be a great discussion tomorrow to look at the life of the Apostle Paul and how to then look at the ministers of Christ, the true minister of Christ. What is that? That'll be our discussion on tomorrow's broadcast. You don't want to miss that at all as well. Okay, with that, let's go ahead and welcome Dr. Carson to the program today. Dr. Carson, it's certainly a pleasure to have you back on the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
It's my privilege to join you again.
Dr. Carson, I wanted to start off right in the very beginning of your book, the introduction. It speaks about the idea of the changing face of tolerance. And you explained that under a phrase called plausible structure. Explain what you mean by that and explain the idea of the changing face of tolerance, if you would, please.
Well, let me begin by the ways in which tolerance have changed. An older tolerance thought that you were tolerant if you permitted someone to speak, even if you disagreed radically with his views. An old saying attributed to various people was, "I may hate what you're saying, but I will defend to the death your right to say it."
Mm-hmm.
So that presupposes, in other words, that there is already a corpus of beliefs out there, of values, of ethics, of rights and wrong, whether they were biblical or not, that there was some sort of structure in society. And then the question became, how much deviation from that structure could be permitted? And not to exercise coercive force to get people in line was being tolerant. To be intolerant was to exercise coercive force, usually the force of the state. Whereas the new tolerance increasingly is taking the position that you must not say another position in a certain domain is wrong. You're a tolerant religious person if you say that all religions are equally right or equally valid, or even if they're not equally valid, then each one has the right to their own views and you don't have the right to say that anybody's wrong.
Hmm.
And the net result of that is that intellectual discussion is inhibited. You can't be honest about disagreements anymore, because as soon as you start saying that somebody else is wrong and these are the 16 reasons why, and get some comeback and pushback and so on, then you're labeled intolerant. And intolerance becomes the supreme evil. And if enough people believe that, if enough people in society believe that, then they come under what Peter Berger used to call a plausibility structure or an implausibility structure. A plausibility structure is a structure of thought widely held in society, in the culture, that makes certain things universally acceptable or just about universally acceptable in the culture. An implausibility structure is just the reverse of that. Just about everybody in the culture thinks that something just really can't be accepted. Hmm. So that if somebody stands up and tries to argue on a secular campus today that Jesus Christ really is the only way to God, and he provided this unique way, this only way, by his own substitutionary death. This was God's plan to reconcile guilty sinners to himself. There is no other way of coming to him. And you give all your reasons for it and all your best apologetics and declare the gospel and so on, so on, so on. The first question that's going to be raised is going to be, what about all the Hindus? Hmm. It's not going to be, how does that truth claim comport with other truth claims? Or how do you know that that's the truth? Or any of that sort of thing. It's going to be, what about all the Hindus? And if you say, well, they must come to know Christ too, then you're intolerant, and the plausibility structure of the implausibility structure of the culture has just ruled you out. You're dismissed right away. And thus there is an increasing need to challenge the controlling coercive effect of culture's plausibility structures, because they start exercising a kind of filtering right that allows in or rules out all kinds of things that before they're even considered or evaluated.
You mentioned in your book that even the definition of tolerance has changed to reflect what you're talking about here with this plausibility structure. Talk about the old English dictionary definition compared with the new Encarta definition, I think it was, or the new way that acceptance is being spoken of.
Well, it, as I said, it used to be that the old plausibility structure, the old definition of tolerance, was heavily bound up with permitting people to speak and defend their views. When you come to Encarta's treatment of the corresponding noun tolerance, there's a subtle change that's appeared. First, acceptance of different views, the accepting of the differing views of other people, e.g. in religious or political matters, and fairness toward the people who hold these different views.
Hmm.
Well, what does accepting the existence of different views mean? Now, it used to be accepting the existence of different views in older definitions. Now it's acceptance of different views. Mm-hmm. To accept their existence means that they have the right to proclaim them. To accept the different views themselves shifts from affirming, recognizing other people's right to have different beliefs or practices to accepting the different views of other people in substance. And that's a massive change.
You also bring out about where the tolerance is actually posited, whether it is posited with the individual or whether it is positive with the substance of their argument. Explain the difference between those two places where tolerance is actually addressed.
Well, in the past, you are tolerant of people if you allow them to speak. If you increasingly, however, to be judged tolerant, you must not simply allow them to speak, but what they say must not say that other views are wrong. In other words, you have to be now tolerant of the substance of their argument, of their content, at least not say that they're wrong. And that has shifted the focus from tolerance of people who have the right to speak versus tolerance of views, even where you think that they're wrong. You're no longer allowed to say that you think that they're wrong. That's intrinsically intolerant. So people become intimidated and want to clam up.
Hmm. You talk about the idea then that this problem of tolerance, even beyond what the dictionary has to say, is really an even greater problem because we have difficulty knowing which meaning people are using when they speak about tolerance. And you give an example in your book, and maybe we could look at this one. The example is a Christian pastor declares, quote, "Christians gladly tolerate other religions," unquote. Now, you talk about a couple of different ways that this could be meant, what is actually meant by this statement. Let's talk about the ways that it could be meant where it would be true to the original definition of tolerance and a way that it would be problematic towards the new definition of tolerance.
Well, Christians gladly tolerate other religions might mean Christians gladly insist that other religions have as much right to exist as Christianity does in our political system. Or does it mean Christians gladly assert that all religions are equally valid? Under the old definition of tolerance, the first is probably what is meant. Under the new definition of tolerance, probably the second is what is meant. And you can flip that around. You Christians are so intolerant, someone says. Does this mean that Christians wish all positions contrary to their own were annihilated, extirpated? Or does it mean that Christians insist that Jesus is the only way to God? But once those two views of tolerance get befuddled in the popular mind, then intolerance becomes the supreme evil. And anybody who's labeled intolerant just becomes identified as a sort of Protestant jihadist or whatever.
Mm. Did I understand it right that you put those two ways of looking at that under two headings? One is a legal tolerance versus a social tolerance. Is that where those two terms come into play?
Well, it's slightly different. They overlap, but one can break out tolerance into a variety of domains. A social tolerance is how you interact with people in the broader society. A legal tolerance is what is demanded by force of law, by the coercion of the state. They overlap, but they're not exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about a couple of modern examples that people see on a regular basis and get your commentary on how Christians should think through these things. One is, I'm sure that you've seen this bumper sticker before that's called, just says coexist on it. And each one of the letters of the word coexist are reshaped so that you can still tell what the letter is, but they're reshaped with symbolism that points to a number of different religions. For instance, one letter looks like the crescent associated with Islam. The T is in the shape of a cross, and so it's speaking about Christianity and so forth. And people have this bumper sticker on their car saying, you know, hey, we just need to all learn how to get along. There's a good way of interpreting that in what you're saying here in the book, that we're not trying to coerce people and use threatening statements or that to get them to believe like we believe. But there's also a bad way of looking at this, right?
Well, of course. Of course. The good way is we don't want to use the coercive power of the state to force people to hold religious views that are not their own. That brings up huge debates in the history of the church about the relationship between church and state. It introduces us to thinking through what Jesus means by render to Caesar the things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God's, about the limits of Christian discipline, the strongest of which is, and it's pretty terrifying, the strongest of which ought to be excommunication from a local church rather than the coercion of the state. So in all of those sorts of ways, Christians ought to celebrate, coexist. But on the other hand, the bad way of taking it is coexist because none of the distinctive claims of those individual religions is more valid than the distinctive claims of any of the other religions. They're all equally valid or equally invalid, or it all depends on your point of view, doesn't really matter. There's no transcendental truth claim. And in that sense, you coexist by denying the importance of anything. And that price is going to be too high to pay for Muslims, for Christians, for Jehovah's Witnesses, for anybody who has any strong notion of truth. In fact, it's worth revisiting the question of plausibility structure. In the West, part of the plausibility-implausibility structure is that you are most tolerant if you refuse to say that anybody is wrong in the domain of religion. Hmm. That's what makes you most tolerant. Hmm. Whereas if you go to the Middle East, that plausibility structure just doesn't exist. Everybody there thinks that only one religion is right. The question is which one. but still, their plausibility structures as they wrestle with these things are so very different. So when devout, pious, and certainly nonviolent Muslims view the Western world, they don't view something that's more attractive here because we're more tolerant. They view something that has paid a huge price to sacrifice the nature of truth. And there's a sense in which they're right. Now, that does not justify the violence of the extremists, of course, but the plausibility structures of our culture are as intellectually incomprehensible and irredeemably foolish as is the stance that wants to try to convert people by blowing them up.
We just spoke with Mindy Belz from World Magazine, and she was articulating for us and telling us about her firsthand experience in Nigeria, recording all the violence that has been committed against Christians there. In light of that, this widespread intolerance among Islam, is it possible for us to say, and do you get all the way to this point in your book? I'm not all the way through it yet, but is it true? Is true tolerance something that is exclusive to true Christianity?
Oh, that's a very complicated one. Depends what you mean by true tolerance. Certainly, in the comparison between Christianity at its best and Islam at its best, there is a fundamental difference of understanding about what is desirable, because Islam has no equivalent in the Quran or in the Hadith or any other traditional source. Nothing equivalent to Christ's "render to Caesar the things that are Caesar and Caesar's and to God the things that are God's." In Islam, the state exists to defend Allah and his revelation. The Ummah, the people of Islam, don't constitute a church within the society. The Ummah is the people of Allah, and the notion of a church within a state is virtually incomprehensible. The obligation of the Muslim state is to defend Islam, and Allah is sovereign over all, and so his law must operate over all. So much of Western debates, insofar as they've come from religious sources, some of them have come from religious sources, and some of them have come from people like Leibniz and so on with another heritage. Insofar as they've come from Christian sources, religious sources, they've really come from an understanding that Jesus himself insists that, unlike the people of the Old Covenant, where the locus of the people of the Old Covenant did constitute a state, under the terms of the New Covenant, the locus of the people of God constitutes an international community, the Church.
Mm-hmm.
And the state and the Church are not to be confused. Now, obviously, there is place for overlap and all kinds of places of confrontation. On the one hand, Romans 13 can tell us, "render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." But the book of Revelation shows pretty powerfully how sometimes the state, how Caesar, becomes so barbaric that Christians have no way to piously, in a righteous way, succumb to Caesar's demands, and therefore they must put up with persecution. They must suffer. You either bear the mark of the beast or the mark of the Lamb on your forehead.
Mm.
And so the New Testament itself recognizes that the ideal distinction between church and state is regularly breached in one fashion or another, but at least there is a distinction there. And out of that has come a great deal of theological reflection and an understanding about where you draw the lines of responsibility and obligation. Already in the book of Acts, if the state suggests that Christians must be quiet about Jesus, then the Apostle Peter can say, we have to obey God rather than man. So where God makes demands of his people, of his blood-bought people, that contradict the demands of the state, then we have to contradict the demands of the state. But on the other hand, there is a fundamental theoretical distinction that goes back to Jesus himself. And ideally, we should be trying to work out and live through a carefully thought through way of acknowledging that Jesus' words in this respect ought to bring order and patience and forbearance and a certain kind of freedom in the culture, which you're not going to get under a totalitarian regime, whether religious or otherwise.
Hmm. I was wondering if you'd help us to think through a modern event as we're trying to think, how do we apply this idea of tolerance and think about it in a biblical way? A news item came across my desk. It's out of the Orange County Register. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but it says, Rick Warren builds bridge to Muslims. I just want to read the opening paragraph. It says, the Reverend Rick Warren, pastor of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest and one of America's most influential Christian leaders, has embarked on an effort to heal divisions between evangelical Christians and Muslims by partnering with Southern California mosques and proposing a set of theological principles that include acknowledging that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. And the article goes on to say that they're doing a number of events together, picnics and soccer games and these types of things. But it also intersperses in there some of these theological truths that they won't try to convert each other, and finding the lowest common denominator theologically between the two groups. I just wanted to get your comment on that. How should we as Christians think about an issue like this?
If Rick Warren, well, first of all, I don't necessarily trust what a newspaper says unless I see primary sources myself and talk to the people involved. But if the newspaper report is true, then I would say the element of potential good is there might be some context in which a local church and a local mosque can join together in cleaning up a park or things of that order.
Mm-hmm.
But to pretend that we are much closer together than we are theologically is a mistake. I suspect that Rick has been influenced by Miroslav's book, Allah, A Christian Response, where he argues very strongly that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. And he does this out of good motives. That is, he wants to lessen the tensions. Mm-hmm. But it's a very slippery sort of argument. They worship the same God in the sense that Islam, at the end of the day, is an offshoot of one branch of Christendom. In that sense, there's some sort of genetic connection. In any pair of monotheistic religions, one can always list the commonalities. Some commonalities are inevitable. But if you push further, the differences are huge. For example, Wolf quotes 1 John 4:7 and 8 and 16b, Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. And then a little farther on, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God, and God in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, starting from this, Wolf says that although this doesn't say anything about the eternal state of anyone, it does tie all genuine love to the one God as its source. But intriguingly, what Wolf leaves out of his quotation from this passage in 1 John are the words, This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. 1 John 4, 9-11. In other words, the Christian understanding of love is tied irretrievably to Jesus' death on the cross, by which he expiated sin, canceled it, and propitiated the Father's wrath. He's an atoning sacrifice for our sins.
Amen.
Which are the very things that Muslims view as at best superstition, if not outright blasphemy, but that Christians see as lying at the very heart of who God is and of how we are to understand what love is.
Mm.
The entire fabric of Christian theology is tied to the grace of God by which he saves his people through the cross and resurrection of his Son.
Amen.
And the entire fabric of Muslim thought, and most Muslims prefer not to think of it as theology, is tied to earning your way to acceptance by Allah the Merciful. These are not minor divergences.
Yeah. Could we say then that this type of tolerance, having picnics and soccer games or whatever, or co-belligerence with other groups, that we run the danger of conveying the validity of Islam? I'm sorry, that music means that we're out of time, but I guess the answer to that, I would assume, is that we need to be careful with these types of events. Would you agree?
We need to be careful, but at the same time, we must do everything we possibly can to avoid giving the impression we're just hate-filled people, too.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree that we can't have picnics and invite for dinner, but we just need to be careful about doing it in an ecclesiastical sense. Dr. Carson, thank you very much for being with us on the program and for writing this very important book. I'm going to give people the information here in just a moment, but thanks again.
You're welcome. Bye now.
Okay. That was Dr. D.A. Carson. His book is called The Intolerance of Tolerance. You can get it from Erdmann's. It's WMB Erdmann's. You can go out to their website, erdmanns.com, to find out more. Remember, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660, WLFJ, Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.